There was a group of five Mexican Americans that won those city council seats. That was a huge, huge shift, and I think a call to the state of Texas that Mexican Americans were serious about political participation. They went on to form La Raza Unida Party. They ran a candidate for a governor here in the state of Texas. And that's the kind of history that we want to tell, one of agency, one of power, one that gets at how Latinos have not simply waited on, but have acted upon to make this country more democratic and more representative for all.
Professor Hinojosa, we want to thank you for being with us of Baylor University in Texas, and Johanna Fernandez, professor of history at City University of New York, Baruch College. And Juan, thank you so much for your book, Harvest of Empire, Stories of Latinos in America. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO is community planted, watered, and grown. Our funding is cultivated by listeners like you. We are looking to harvest $55,000 for this fall drive to support our organic, bountiful programming. Take root by becoming a member today. Just go to kboo.fm/give to donate, or text KBOO to 44321. Thank you.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, the Federal Trade Commission and 17 states sue Amazon for antitrust violations. Willamette Cove is safe to swim in after 2 months of toxic algae warnings. And in national news, an Arizona judge blocks a law intended to disenfranchise Native voters. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 26, 2023. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Eric Leuschner. The Federal Trade Commission and 17 states, including Oregon, sue Amazon on antitrust charges. They allege that Amazon is illegally protecting its monopoly over online retail. They also say that Amazon inflates its online prices and overcharges sellers. It's the result of a years-long investigation and represents one of the most significant legal challenges brought against the e-commerce giant in the 30 years they've been in business. The lawsuit alleges that Amazon has violated federal and state antitrust laws, and it asks the court to permanently ban Amazon from illegal price fixing and loosen its, quote, monopolistic control to restore competition. The lawsuit says Amazon was able to influence sellers into not offering lower prices on other sires. The lawsuit says Amazon was able to influence sellers into not offering lower prices on other sites by promoting the recognizable Buy Now and Add to Cart buttons for those products. Amazon also charges sellers high fees, forcing sellers to increase prices and replace relevant search results with its own ads. Amazon is estimated to control about 40% of the e-commerce market. Most of their sales are done through independent sellers, individuals, and small or medium-sized businesses. In return, Amazon gobbles up billions in fees from sellers, now taking an around 35% cut from sellers in 2020, compared to 19% 6 years prior. Amazon has said the Federal Trade Commission is, quote, wrong on the facts and on the law. Consumer advocacy groups have applauded the lawsuit, and speculation persists as to whether the FTC will try to break up the megacorporation. Students are still struggling behaviorally in the wake of COVID-19 lockdowns. A training program brought an anti-violence workshop to a Seattle-area high school this year. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
Skills for reducing violence are becoming essential in schools. At the beginning of the school year, students at a Washington State high school participated in a workshop aimed at doing that. The Alternatives to Violence Project mostly works in jails and prisons around the world. This time, Evergreen High School in King County was the host. Roger Cluck is head of the Projects for a Civil Society, the Puget Sound area organization that offers the training locally. He says the COVID-19 lockdown is still affecting kids' behavior.
The kids have lost social graces, social skills, social emotional skills. They don't know how to get along with each other after not being in the classroom for long periods of time.
Cluck's organization wasn't able to offer the workshop to all 1,000 students at the high school, so it was just for ninth graders this year. To have enough staff, Cluck says they put out an international call. Three facilitators traveled from New Zealand and three traveled from Kenya to participate. Cluck says the ninth graders were timid at first and were reluctant to answer questions in large groups, so they broke the numbers down.
If we put them in groups of two, three, or four, they really enjoyed talking to each other, and we'd have them share, what's your favorite activity? What do you enjoy doing? What's something about yourself that nobody knows?
Cluck says the training operates under the idea that hurt people hurt people.
A lot of our violence prevention works in healing people from their own psychic pain and teaching them to be empathetic and compassionate, because if I see you as being like me, it's much harder for me to want to do violence to you.
Cluck says his organization plans to bring the Alternatives to Violence Project again to freshmen at Evergreen High School next year. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
It is now safe to swim and boat on the Willamette River in North Portland. That's according to the Oregon Health Authority, who lifted their health advisory against water recreation because of a cyanobacteria bloom. The whole Willamette through Portland isn't out of the woods yet. A health advisory is still in effect further south, near the Ross Island Lagoon. The advisory for Willamette Cove started July 28. Cyanobacteria, or blue-green algae, thrives in slow-moving warm water, and there's lots of nutrients, like from fertilizer or sewage. It can be harmful to people and pets when it's inhaled or absorbed through the skin. Only a few sites across the state are monitored for toxic algae blooms like this, so the health authority says it's important to know the signs. People should avoid areas where the water is foamy, scummy, thick like paint, pea green, or blue green. If you see thick brownish-red mats or visible bright green clumps suspended in the water, that's another important sign not to swim or inhale the droplets. Blooms can develop or fade depending on when conditions are favorable, so they can still exist in clear water. Senator Robert Mendez offers explanations on the money found in his home. Nonpartisan groups urge Congress to avert a government shutdown. And a Nevada organization works to build Latino political engagement. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
For 30 years, I have withdrawn thousands of dollars in cash from my personal savings account, which I have kept for emergencies and because of the history of my family facing confiscation in Cuba.
New Jersey Senator Robert Menendez is trying to explain the $500,000 in cash federal investigators found at his home. Menendez is maintaining his innocence to the bribery, fraud, and extortion charges he's been indicted on and says he won't resign despite calls to do so. Previous corruption charges against him ended in a 2015 mistrial. With 4 days left to avoid a shutdown, nonpartisan and nonprofit groups are pushing Congress to keep the government open. Make the Road Action in New York is pressing Republican Representative Anthony D'Esposito to stand up to hard-right Republicans holding up passage of funding bills. Angel Reyes-Rivas is with the group.
A solution would be for the people, being Democrat or being Republican, that really care about these communities and understand the importance of these benefits to pass something, right? Because a government shutdown is unacceptable.
In a shutdown, Social Security checks still go out, though some SNAP benefits might not, and some Medicare services could be delayed. According to the New York Times, a bipartisan group of senators is working on a plan to keep the government funded. The upper house does not normally originate budget bills, but the Times reports senators are now discussing a funding measure with the White House and considering whether to include more aid for Ukraine. A federal judge is blocking a 2022 Arizona law requiring registered voters to provide proof of a physical address. Supporters say it would aid election integrity and stop illegal voting, but Allison Nesswood with the Native American Rights Fund says there are more than 40,000 homes on reservations without a physical address, and the people who live there could lose their voice.
wanting to make sure that a new law that's sort of targeting the specific structural issues that Native Americans face was really important, I mean, for the tribes who participated in the case and who brought the issue forward and wanted to make sure that these addressing issues didn't get lost.
With a deal in the writer's strike looking likely, attention in Hollywood is turning to the actor's strike. When they return to bargaining, it'll be 2 months since the studios met with the actors' union. For Hispanic Heritage Month, Battleborn Progress in Nevada is reaching out to the Latino third of the state's people to make them more politically engaged. Maite Guerra with the group says given this population's hunger for information, the group is developing an accessible information hub for Spanish speakers in the Silver State.
Something else that we're doing is fact-checking a lot of right-wing politicians. So just making sure that what is being said in the political sphere is accurate and not targeting our community.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hey, how are you? Well, they're cute.
The Oregon Supreme Court is asked to decide if Oregon GOP legislators who walked out of the legislative session can be reelected. They were asked to take the case on formally by the Oregon Court of Appeals on Monday. The Supreme Court has 20 days to grant or deny the request. The senators who walked out are challenging the ballot measure passed by Oregon voters in the 2022 election. It would bar lawmakers from running in their next term if they had 10 or more unexcused absences from the Capitol during the session. Republican senators say there's ambiguity in how the measure is worded because it references the election after their term ends. Next year, their terms end in 2025, but the election will have been in November of 2024. Secretary of State LaVon Griffin-Vallade announced in August that the senators would be disqualified from running again. She said her decision, quote, honors the voters' intent by enforcing the measure the way it was commonly understood when Oregonians added it to our state constitution, end quote. The senators sued her in a court of appeals, setting up the current request in front of the state Supreme Court. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek unveiled a plan today to step up Oregon State Police patrols to address the spread of fentanyl. Troopers will be moved to some of the areas hardest hit by fentanyl use and team up with other law enforcement agencies in highly visible shows of force. Other specific details are scarce, with Kotek and state troopers keeping other strategies close to the vest. Kotek said in a statement, quote, I want all Oregonians to know that the state is moving forward with several new fentanyl strategic enforcement and disruption strategies, end quote. Voting rights advocates in Arizona are pleased to see a federal judge strike down a state requirement that they say would have led to voter disenfranchisement for Native Americans. One legal expert contends that many already faced challenges to getting and casting a ballot. Alex Gonzalez reports.
A federal judge has blocked a 2022 Arizona law that voting rights advocates say would have made it harder for some Native Americans to vote. House Bill 2492 required that all registered voters provide proof of a physical address to cast a ballot. But the Native American Rights Fund contends more than 40,000 homes located on reservations don't have a physical address. Staff attorney with the fund, Allison Neswood, says they're pleased with the decision, which ensures that citizens living in tribal communities can vote.
Wanting to make sure that, you know, this a new law that's sort of targeting the specific structural issues that Native Americans face was really important, I mean, for the tribes who participated in the case and who brought the issue forward and wanted to make sure that these addressing issues didn't get lost.
Neswood explains the judge's ruling means the bill's addressing requirement must be liberally interpreted so that no one is required to have a standard street address in order to vote. This also means a voter's identity can be verified at the polling place using an Arizona-issued ID that lists a P.O. box or any tribal identification document. Neswood argues cases like this show tribal members care a lot about being able to exercise their voting rights and will defend those rights when threatened. She adds Native Americans across the country face what she calls overlapping barriers, which can make civic engagement more challenging in these communities.
These systemic issues stacked on top of each other make it harder for Native Americans to access the ballot. And then, of course, you know, just because of the historical treatment of Native American people, we have higher rates of poverty, higher rates of homelessness, which just increases the challenges of navigating all of those barriers.
She contends using addresses in voter registration and election processes already already make it hard for Native Americans to participate in elections, even without the new law. Last year, then-Governor Doug Ducey signed the law, citing efforts to instill election integrity and prohibit attempts to vote illegally. For Arizona News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $55,000 by the end of October. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. They're discussing the Who Will Own the Forest conference that's happening in Portland this week and the Community Counter Summit and Rally. At 6 o'clock, it's Rise Up with Sonali, then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 53 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 64. Today in history, in 2016, Tuffy, the last known Rob's fringe-limbed tree frog, died. The species at one time inhabited the forest canopies of Panama. It's now considered a possible extinct species. The quote of the day is from Canadian author Brain Tracy, who wrote the book Eat That Frog. Tracy wrote, quote, "You cannot eat every tadpole and frog in the pond, but you can eat the biggest and ugliest one, and that will be enough, at least for the time being." Stalo First Nation in British Columbia found nearly 160 child deaths across four facilities in BC. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas from KMBA in Anchorage, Alaska, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. A First Nation in British Columbia says it has found nearly 160 child deaths at four facilities in the province. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, most of the deaths occurred at a hospital.
The probe by the Stalo Nation in British Columbia focused on unmarked graves and missing children going back to the 1860s. But representatives of the First Nation and its Research and Resource Management Center say the work is only beginning. So far, obstacles have been the lack of access to information from Ottawa, as well as religious institutions that were linked to residential schools. The research, using ground-penetrating radar, archives, and fieldwork, was into three residential schools, cemeteries, and a First Nation hospital. Most of the children died of diseases such as tuberculosis, some from accidents. Amber Kostuchenko is a researcher and the project manager.
One child died because they were jumped on by another student. Another child was reported to have hit their head against the bed under unknown circumstances. and another was reported to have broken their spine while jumping rope.
The institutions included the St. Mary's Residential School, the Kokolitsa Industrial Institute, and the Kokolitsa Hospital, all three in British Columbia's Fraser Valley, and the fourth was the All Hallows School in Yale, B.C. Kostachenko says her team is still gathering information and has only accessed about half of the 70,000 documents they need. One of the lead researchers also says interviews with survivors suggested many atrocities committed against children, including sexual assaults, starvation, and secret burials. Some survivors alleged that the St. Mary's School was a place of punishment and starvation, and later, when it moved to a second location, a place of pedophilia. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
For years, it was extremely difficult to find meals like bison pot roast or an elk taco at a restaurant. Yet Indigenous cuisine has been in the Americas for centuries. The Mountain West News Bureau's Emma Vandernindy joined a chef in a Denver community kitchen to see her approach to the cuisine.
Chef Andrea Murdoch is busy in the kitchen. She's baking her light blue sugar cookies with the help of some volunteer chefs.
They're like blue.
Yeah, they stay blue. It's awesome.
They do?
Yeah.
That color is made from Ute Mountain Ute cornmeal from Southwest Colorado.
Blue cornmeal is something that's very specific to the Four Corners region of the U.S. Like, you will not find this easily out on the West Coast, out on the East Coast.
And this isn't the first time she's used unique ingredients.
I source locally and indigenously to support those economies. Kroger doesn't need my money.
It all started when Murdoch expanded Four Directions Cuisine, her food business. She wanted to create South American cuisine. And through her research, she found that ingredients representative of the culture were pre-colonial, like rabbit, bison, or other foods that existed in the Americas before colonizers arrived. Along with sourcing food from local and indigenous farmers, she forages around her for flowers and grasses, praying to the weather god Iapa for rain. As she cooks, she taps into what she calls her sixth sense and connects with plants and animals that are seen as relatives in her culture.
There's an element of listening to the ingredients and understanding how you're going to honor them best.
Indigenous cuisine, like Murdoch's, has recently grown in popularity, with many restaurants opening in cities like Minneapolis and Seattle. And for the second year in a row, a Native chef won a James Beard Award, almost like the Oscars for cooking. But it wasn't always this way, and there's still room to grow.
We find food from all over the world in our amazing cities, and very seldom do we find food of where we happen to be standing that represents the land and the indigenous communities and cultures.
That's Sean Sherman, head chef of Awamni in Minnesota, and a multi-James Beard Award winner.
And we should really be focused on what's the true food of North America, and you can't understand North American food unless you bring the indigenous perspective into it.
For National Native News, I'm Emma Vandenindy.
I'm Jill Freitas.
Maybe you've heard the phrase, opposites attract. A new analysis of data shows that might not be true. Instead, partners are more inclined to be similar rather than different. The analysis looked at political and religious attitudes, level of education, and certain measures of IQ. Roz Brown has more on the story.
The age-old theory that opposites attract has been debunked, according to analysis of more than 130 traits in a study that included millions of couples over more than a century. The authors found that partners are more likely to be similar than wildly different. Tanya Horwitz, a doctoral student at the University of Colorado, says some 82 to 89% of traits analyzed, ranging from political leanings to substance use habits, reveal people tend to find partners with similar habits.
People meet the people they get into relationships with often within social networks. So if a person spends a lot of time in bars or taking substances, they are probably also going to meet a lot of other people who have similar substance use patterns.
Horwitz says the analysis shows individuals tend to partner with those who are different for only 3% or less of the traits studied. Meanwhile, traits like height and weight, medical conditions, and personality showed far lower but still positive correlations. The study did not include same-sex couples because their patterns may differ significantly, which the authors are now exploring separately. While the study showed partner resemblance was far more similar than dissimilar, Horwitz notes sleep patterns were a surprising outlier.
We're looking at tens of thousands of couples, so it was a large sample. But we did find that if you're a morning person, you are slightly more likely in the sample to be in a long-term relationship with a night owl. And we kind of don't know why we found this.
She says the study involved two methods. A meta-analysis looked at 22 traits across 199 studies, including millions of male-female co-parents and engaged, married, or cohabiting pairs. It also includes analysis of 133 traits across almost 80,000 opposite-sex pairs in the United Kingdom. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
As climate projects take shape around the U.S., policymakers and environmental organizations hope younger generations will assume the roles needed to make the ideas come alive. Mike Moen has more on these efforts in Minnesota.
If states like Minnesota are going to meet their climate goals, experts say younger workers will need to step into the roles to make it happen, like forest management. The Biden administration is reviving plans for that type of workforce. The White House has announced its American Climate Corps project, which involves hiring 20,000 people to be trained for these positions. And Minnesota is among the states moving forward with their own similar efforts. While young adults are being eyed for the work, Julia Nurbun with Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light says it's an opportunity for cross-generational learning.
Getting some of these young people into places where they can learn from elders in their community and folks who are out there getting the job done will be valuable. But I also think that all of us have a lot to learn from the next generation.
The move comes as President Joe Biden faces more pressure from youth climate activists who want him to be more aggressive in pursuing mitigation efforts. An earlier larger-scale workforce model was scrapped during congressional negotiations. The plan has drawn comparisons to the Civilian Conservation Corps in the 1930s. Danielle Hefferin with the group Climate Generation says students have shown great concern about the need for environmental solutions. But she says it isn't enough to push schools to teach them about it, adding that these state and federal initiatives give them clear pathways for many different roles.
There's communication folks, storytellers, farmers, so many different roles that could be a, quote, climate job and help advance towards climate solutions.
Peter Nelson is with Serve Minnesota, which oversees AmeriCorps programs in Minnesota. He sees these new efforts enhancing their climate work, such as getting folks trained to recruit volunteers.
And we want to get people into these service programs to get them employed, working in an area that they're passionate about. But it's also about getting the word out, engaging with our community, because it really is all hands on deck situation.
This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection.
The world's poorest people won't be able to migrate to escape climate disasters. A Harvard researcher says climate change-driven heat waves, drought, and floods will push vulnerable people into more extreme poverty. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Climate change will cause more intense droughts, extreme flooding, and crippling heat waves in many parts of the world. In response, some people may become climate refugees. But Aylin Benvenist of Harvard University found that as conditions become more extreme, it will get harder for many of the world's poorest and most vulnerable people to move, so some will be unable to escape.
It's costly to move, particularly if you're going to move further away, and especially if you're going to move across borders.
Climate change-driven heat waves, droughts, and floods can damage crops and destroy houses, pushing low-income people even further into poverty. Extreme weather could also make it more difficult for just one or two family members to move away and send money back home.
What that means is kind of a double whammy. You have climate change impacts in origin communities in those locations, but you also have limited options of having access to credit that is being sent back to origin communities because migrants are not being able to leave in the first place.
So Benvenist says that as much as the world is focused on climate refugees, we also need to pay attention to people who cannot afford to escape climate disasters at all. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 26, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tagadoff, Jill Freitas, Alex Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Mike Moen, Roz Brown, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now is a great time to join if you would like to become a member and support our programming. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.